This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to be with you for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming live or podcast on our HRN website. And, of course, you're listening there at horseracingradio.net. Well, each week as I start to get ready for this Trainer Talk show, the first thing I do is log on to Equibase, and I check the statistics of the guest that I'm going to be having on the program. Then I look up their biography to get a little bit more background information and maybe pull out a few things that we can talk about throughout the program. Every once in a while, when you look up a record of a trainer, you see a zero in the win column accompanied by a very limited number of starters, indicating, of course, that that particular trainer is just getting started with their training career. That is the case with today's guest. She has learned from veteran trainers like Kelly Breen and Tom Morley, and she is now starting her own journey. She has saddled just two starters to date, and both have finished in the money. She had 1 second and 1/3. Not too shabby. I know she wants to get that first win out of the way. It'll come soon enough. Please join me in welcoming trainer Michelle Giangiulio to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Michelle, thanks for taking some time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, excited to hear your story and talk about this journey that you've been on. And I have to tell you, when you Google people like Todd Pletcher or Bill Mott or Steve Asmussen, there is more information than one person could possibly sift through. And we may very well be saying that same thing about you one day, I have no doubt. But for now, let's just start at the beginning. Where were you raised, and how did you come to fall in love with horse racing?
Well, I was born and raised in New Jersey, South Jersey, and was actually born and raised on a horse farm. My parents owned and bred thoroughbreds when I was a kid, actually, off of our farm. We used to foal horses there. And, you know, that's basically where it got started. I didn't really follow the horse racing too much when I was a younger kid. My parents tried to kind of keep me more on the show horse end, and that's kind of where I got started. Used to be in 4-H and did horse shows there, and eventually ventured out to the horse racing world when I got into my 20s. So that's kind of a little bit of how things got started with the horses.
Did your parents
to get to where I am now, but it's been good so far. It's really exciting.
Yeah, you said your parents didn't necessarily want you to, you know, be involved with the horses right away when you were very young.
Yeah.
What was the reaction when you told them?
Even when I did first start getting involved in it, they still were kind of against it. They really didn't want me to go that way, but I knew I wanted to do something with horses. That was a no-brainer. My whole life, I always wanted to do something as far as being some kind of horse trainer. I just wasn't quite set on what discipline I wanted to do, so I basically worked my way through getting to where I am now. I started working on a show farm near my parents' house in Williamstown, New Jersey, when I was 13. And I was actually, I had a quarter horse mare that I had that I wanted to train to, you know, go to the shows with. And I basically worked to pay my training bill and, you know, cleaned stalls and broke horses and did all kinds of things over there for those people. And it was a great learning experience. I worked there for about 8 or 9 years before I actually ventured out to the to the horse racing world. So that was like my basic foundation of how I got started professionally with horses.
Are there things that you learned working with show horses that, you employ when you're working with thoroughbreds now?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Are there things that you learned when you were working with the show horses that you'll take and utilize and employ when you're working with the thoroughbreds now?
Oh, absolutely. There's so much more discipline involved in show horses than there is with the racehorses, actually. So you learn so much of the basic foundations of just breaking a horse in general. And that helps so much when you're, you know, riding a racehorse, because they are pretty green. It's a very basic foundation they have on them. You know, they know how to steer. They know how to go forward. There's not much more to it. They don't have much brakes, you know. So the show world is totally different. They're very, very well broke horses from they start actually a little bit younger than the racehorses do. They start, you know, groundwork as a yearling and everything, and they do all of that. But there's years and years and years of training that goes into show horses. It doesn't just happen within months where we're getting on their back and then they're just started out, you know, getting fit, basically, is what they do with the racehorses. The show horses, it takes years to have a horse fully broke to where you want them to be. It's a completely different world than it is to the racehorses, but it definitely, every day, just dealing with just basic horsemanship is totally different in the show world. But yeah, I would say I use things that I learned then every day around the horses now, even now, still. Always appreciate that, because it was definitely a huge learning experience for me that I'll always, you know, take along with me.
Did you compete with the show horses, Michelle?
Yeah, I did. I didn't really go too nationally with it. It was very expensive. My family really couldn't afford to go as big as we wanted to go. You know, it was really difficult. You needed to know the right people. I mean, we were involved with the right group of people, but couldn't really expand to where we wanted to go. You know, so basically enjoyed it, did as much as I could, worked as hard as I could, and just enjoyed the experience.
When you finally shifted over to thoroughbreds, did you think about maybe being a jockey and riding them too?
No, I was never. I knew I would never be able to be a jockey with my size. I'm 5'9", and I was always a bigger build. So I would have loved to do it if I could, but I would have never been able to make weight. And I like to eat, so that's another problem. But if I could have, I probably would have, because I love riding. I love going fast, and you know, racing is awesome. But you know, my body was not built for that kind of thing.
Before we started the show, we talked about the fact that I am of Italian heritage. You are Italian. My producer back in the studio, Lee, is Italian. So we have an all-Italian cast here on Trainer Talk today. You said you like to eat. I do, too. What's your favorite food?
Yes. Italian. I love Italian food. I'm not too picky. I eat quite – I'll try anything. But yes, I absolutely love Italian food for sure.
Yeah, you can't beat it. We actually went to Italy a couple of years ago, and you talk about falling in love with Italian food. We think it's good here in the States. It's nothing compared to what they have in Italy, obviously.
Oh, I agree. I actually went to Italy when I was 16 with my family, and it was an experience of a lifetime for sure. I mean, we actually got to go and stay with family, but the food was just out of this world. There's just no comparison to even good restaurants. You know, in New York, there's a lot of good Italian restaurants here, but you still can't compare the quality of food that they have in Italy to here. It's just unbelievable.
So back to the show horses for a minute. You said you were competing, you were riding a bit, but, you know, not necessarily on the big scale, so to speak. Did you have a couple of show horses that are always going to hold a special place in your heart?
Yeah, I do have one. Her name is Dixie. She's actually still alive. I bought her when she was 4 years old. I think she's 19 now. I did actually end up selling her because I didn't have time for her anymore. But really nice family now. But she'll always hold a spot to me because when I bought her, she was with, I can't exactly remember the name of the farm that she was on, but they had bought her from somebody that had like a few kids that were just kind of taking care of her. She was actually really, really malnourished. Never had a saddle on her, nothing. She was, as green as grass. Nice mare though. And I ended up buying her for $4,000 or $5,000. I think I was like 14 or 15 at the time when I bought her. And, I broke her from the ground up and she wasn't the first horse I had ever broke that was that green, but she was a little bit older, so she was kind of difficult to break because she was a little bit older. So it was like, it was a more time consuming and I had to be really patient with her because she was such a good minded horse, but it just took time to get her to learn everything that we were teaching her. And she ended up becoming a really nice show horse. We didn't actually win anything major, but she became such a nice horse from, you know, where she got started. And she could have competed at top level if I was able to get her to all the shows and everything. I was always working a lot. You know, I started a full-time job at like 13, 14 years old on the farm. So the farm that I was actually training my horses on, I was working for them as well. So I was training with them and breaking horses for them along with trying to train and break my horse and go to shows. So it was difficult to get bigger, you know, because I was always kind of running the farm. So I didn't really get to compete all too much. I don't really have, you know, anything to show that she was a really nice horse, but she'll always hold a spot in my heart. She was a special one.
With all that time you were spending on the farm and around the horses at a very young age, how are you able to balance your education and working with the horses?
You know, I was in high school. I was never really big into school. Let me put it that way. You know, I wasn't like a big studier. I just kind of got by. I always just wanted to be outside. I was everybody would consider me a barn rat is the best way to put it. Cause I just never would leave the barn. You know, horses were my life. That's all I wanted to do. So, you know, I got through school. And when I was working on the farm, I would go afterwards. As soon as I get done, I was actually driving at 16. I had a farmer's license, so I was able to go right from school to work. Then I worked the afternoons and ride. And then I'd work through the weekends and help clean stalls in the morning, and, you know, and then we would train the horses after we were done, you know, cleaning stalls and everything. But yeah, I worked hard as a young kid. I did. It was a lot of work, but
like
I loved what I was doing, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, and what a great education for what you're doing now.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. It was a great experience. I'll always appreciate that. And I worked with good people that taught me a lot that I didn't really, you know, when I grew up in 4-H and did those kind of shows, it's a very basic kind of shows. It's not that competitive or anything. So when I got involved with these two trainers, they really taught me a lot, and it'll always be me along the way as long as I work with horses.
What was your parents' reaction when you told them that you were going to do this for a living?
Everybody, it was kind of funny because everybody was kind of against it. They didn't think I would be able to do it because the hours are so different. You know, you don't get days off. I used to get weekends off. You know, I'd start 8 o'clock in the morning, work all day, but you know, I'd have days off and it was like a normal kind of schedule. So racetrack, it's not like that. And I had never really worked that way. You know, they're just like, oh, you might get a day off every other week. And I'm like, what? You know, this is crazy. But once I started, I didn't actually start first on the racetrack. I started on a farm, Mount Holly Farms in Jersey, which is about a half hour from Parks, is where I originally got started, which was a perfect place to get started, to just, you know, basically understand everything about horse racing and what you got to do with the racehorses and training and grooming. I first started out, I started with Carlos Guerrero, who's actually my uncle, and, you know, he brought me into the farm and he had me hot walking for him for about a week. And then he basically just hovered over my shoulder every little step of the way, and any little mistake I made, he was right there. And I mean, he taught me so much. I will always cherish the time that he took to teach me as he did, because I don't think he's ever taught anyone as much as he taught me in such a short period of time. Like, within a year, I was an assistant trainer, full on, like, doing everything that a normal assistant would do, from going from hot walker to groomed assistant so quickly. But it was just, you know, I needed to learn how things were done. It was still horses, you know, it was just a whole different operation, but, you know, it was still horses. And I was so into what I was doing. I was so excited about it. So, you know, I caught on to it quickly. Yeah, it was a good time. I was there for about a year and a half till they did go onto the racetrack. And then, but it was a great spot to start before you get to the racetrack, because it is a lot different once you get to the racetrack from being on a farm.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, great learning experience, too. Talking with Michelle Giangiulio, she is just getting started with her training career. Two starters to date. She has a second and a third. Not too bad. She will get her first win before too long. As you can hear, she is passionate about the horse. This is what she has always wanted to do ever since she was a little girl, and she is now living that dream. Michelle, let me ask you a little bit more about Carlos. You said your uncle. He's had considerable success throughout his career. What are some of the things that you learned from him that maybe help you today?
Oh, he taught me so much. I don't want to knock any trainers that I've worked for, but he's one of the best horsemen that I've ever been around. I have yet to meet anyone do as much as he does. And I don't know if I know someone that loves the animal as much as he does, because he's incredible. So everything that he taught me comes with me every single day, because no one has ever taught me as much as he has. I mean, yeah, he started me from the ground up. You know, I didn't know much about racehorses when I started with him, but he taught me everything that he knows. And I'll cherish that for the rest of my life, because, you know, it comes with me every single day. When I go over a horse, I think, what would Carlos do? All the time, because we had so much success together. We did win a lot of races, and we worked so good together. It was a great time. It was a great learning experience, and we won a lot of races together. It was awesome.
I love the word that you used to describe him when you said the word horseman. And I have always said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is a distinct difference between a horseman and a horse trainer. Is that true?
Absolutely. There's horse trainers out there that could get a full string of horses, 30, 40 horses, and train them all the same way and be really successful at it, because they got a good string of horses. And, you know, you do have to have a little bit of luck, but, you know, sometimes you get lucky that way. Sometimes, you know, when we're at a track like Parks, which is a little bit lower level, and you get cheaper horses, you got to be a horseman to get those horses to run. You know, there's a lot of horses that are a lot of work and they have issues, and you got to get them right. And you know, you can't just train every single horse the same way. You got to do how the horse, you know, what makes them happy and what's keeping them healthy and sound. So you really got to, you know, come up with a plan differently for each horse, and that's something that Carlos does, and that's something that he excels at, and everybody knows that around Parks, because, you know, he always keeps a high percentage, and he's had a very successful career, especially in the last couple of years. He had fun to run in the Breeders' Cup, and
yeah,
it was awesome to see him succeed like that, because that's the race that he's ever won, and, like, you know, it's long overdue. Like, he should have won races like that years ago. So it was great to see. You know, it still brings tears in my eyes just thinking of it. It was an awesome day.
What do you remember about that day? Where were you watching?
I was actually watching from my apartment. I think we were running horses that day. I was with Morley. I think we had a couple horses run at Belmont that day, or at Aqueduct. and I made it home. I think I made it home just in time. They were heading into the gate, and, oh, man, I was screaming my head off. And my dog was going crazy, too, because I was screaming, you know. It was just me and the dog, but it was still just an awesome moment to see that. I remember I was recording a video of him afterwards in the interview and everything. It was just, it was so exciting.
Yeah, super tough horse, too. I mean, Spun to Run was, you know, as honest as they come. And you now know, being around horses on your own and training, that when you get a horse that shows up every single time you lead him over, that horse is rare, but boy, it is so special.
It really is. Yeah, it is something special. Like, it was a filly that I dealt with when I was with Tom, La Monita. She was another one that was pretty special. We won a lot of, I think we won three or four in a row with her. And she was really difficult to train. She always had to go with the pony, and she had to have a certain rider on her back. There was only a few people that really got along with her. But we had a system down for her so well that worked for her. And it was something, you know, we just did the same thing every single day with her, and it just worked good. She had her own little schedule, and she loved it, and it, you know, it worked really well for her. We won the Yaddo in Saratoga with her, and I think we won two allowance races with her, and she finished second in a stake at Laurel. I think it was a grade three, actually. But yeah, she was one that will always stick with me too. She was a pretty special mare.
You know, that's one of the really cool things about this sport, Michelle. And as I'm listening to you talk and tell these stories, I'm thinking about the way that people in our game, people that work on the backside each and every morning, and they get up early and they work so hard, like yourself and like so many people in the sport, they tend to, unless you're in the same race with somebody, you're always finding people and horses that you can cheer for. Right? Of course, when you're in the same race, you want to try and beat them and you want to win. But if you're not, everybody's kind of always cheering for somebody else, which I think is such a unique dynamic of thoroughbred racing.
I always support the hard-knocking horses, you know, that always show up, even like the older ones. Even if they're running a like cheaper race, if it's an older horse and I'm not in the race or something, you know, I'm always like rooting on them, you know, come on, like get him there. And tearing them onto the wire a little bit. I love those kind of horses.
Yeah, you can't beat those kind. Michelle G and Julio with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. So you mentioned working with your uncle and then going to the racetrack and being around the horses there. Take me through the progression. Where did you go, and how did you end up where you are today?
So I stayed at Parks for 2 or 3 years, I think, and went through a couple rough winters there. It was not easy. It's a tough racetrack to work at. And I had visited Belmont once. We ran a horse up here when I was still with Carlos, and I absolutely loved it up here. I was like, wow, not so much the area, you know, because I'm kind of from like the country, you know, I'm more like open land. My parents were on a 40-acre farm, but I absolutely loved Belmont itself. And I was like, wow, this place, you know, I said to myself when I came up here, I said, I'll be here one day. And I, as much as I enjoyed working where I was, I knew it wasn't where I wanted to be. I felt like I wanted to be on a bigger level, because Parks, you know, not knocking Parks, it's a good track and it's good money and, you know, the racing's good, but it's not Belmont, you know, the Naira racing is like a whole nother level. And I wanted to be involved in that. And I actually ended up getting a job with Brown, and that's how I came to New York. A friend of mine knew Cherie DeVoe, and they were looking for a foreman / like assistant, somebody to bring up, you know, somebody to train. And I ended up getting the job, and I worked there for almost a year. Might have been a little bit shy of a year, and that was an experience of a lifetime. Let me tell you, coming from Parks to work for Todd Brown in New York, it was like a huge step up. You know, I felt like it was a dream come true. And It was really an experience to be on that level from where I was coming from. It was, it was an eye opener, and I learned a lot. And my ears were always open to learn as much as I could. And to work with the quality horses that I got to work with was, it was an experience of a lifetime for sure.
Yeah, you talk about going from the first floor to the penthouse overnight. You go to work for a guy like Chad Brown. I can imagine that there were so many things that you learned being around Chad and around those really good horses that are even helping you now as you get started.
Yeah, the biggest thing I learned, I didn't really get to work around too much turf horses at parks, because the season's pretty short over there. You don't get quality turf horses to go to parks. So I learned a lot just dealing with that. Alone being with horses at, a grade one level and, multiple Breeders' Cup champions. You walk down the shed row and every stall horse is just another champion. It's just each name gets bigger and bigger as you walk down the shed row. It was just absolutely an amazing experience.
Do good horses know that they're good, Michelle?
Some of them do. Some of them really do. You have some that are just really classy and are just like such just really nice horses to be around. And then you have some that really know what they're doing. You can tell that they're really focused when they're in the paddock, when they're getting saddled, that they're really like ready to run. The horse that was so smart and will always like stay with me was Big Blue Kitten. He was so awesome. Like, I've never seen a horse be so proud of himself after he's won a race. I mean, he just strutted his stuff when he was walking around the test barn after he won the Manhattan. That horse was just, like, awesome to watch run and to see him afterwards just, like, be so proud of himself. He was really cool. He was a really cool horse.
When you get a horse that's smart like that and shows up and wins races, big races too, how do you reward them afterwards?
You want them to have their rest, that's for sure. I mean, we would always have carrots and candies and everything, which they always appreciate. But for me, I feel like the biggest reward for a racehorse is to let them have the rest that they need and let them recoup. And, some of them want to go right back into training, and some of them want to, take 3 or 4 days off and just relax and be themselves in the stall and just sleep the day away. They're all different. But, you want to spoil them as much as you can.
Yeah, every trainer that I've ever had on this program, or pretty much every trainer, has always said one of the keys is treating horses as an individual and not just tailoring a program saying this is going to work for every horse. And it's like that's one thing you've learned too.
Yeah, absolutely. Just with working with so many different quality horses, they're all so different in so many ways. And you can't treat every horse the same because they don't, excel from certain things. They all have their own personality. They all have their certain ways they want to train, certain things they want to eat, and they got their own personality.
Yeah, they have their own personalities, and they're all different, and that's what makes this sport, one of the things that makes this sport so special. Visiting with trainer Michelle Giangiulio here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Going to get to a short break. We'll continue to talk about her journey, and we'll tell you about the horses that she has in her care right now. When we come back, this is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Fasic Tipton is offering buyers a bonanza of sales this July. First, on Monday, July 12th, Fasic Tipton will kick things off with a catalog of July breeding stock featuring the Far From Over Fountain of Youth Dispersal, followed next by the popular July Selected Horses of Racing Age sale, a sale that has produced the earners of more than $51 million since first being held in 2013. Then, on Tuesday, July 13th, it's the July sale of selected yearlings, featuring the return of the Freshman Sire Showcase. 348 yearlings selected on pedigree and confirmation by Fasic Tipton's renowned inspection team, with recent Grade 1 winning graduates like Bell's the One, Kamari, and Speech you need to buy in July. July breeding stock and selected horses of racing age, and the July sale of selected yearlings. July 12th and 13th in Lexington, Kentucky at Fasic Tipton. Where will you be?
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Omaha Beach is going to make his move on the far outside. He's floated very wide. He went four deep on the turn, but he's starting to pick it up. And they're into the stretch with Spun to Run and Catch. The Wonder Catch coming to the gate pole. Spun to Run drifting out with the lead. Blue Chipper on the inside is second. Omaha Beach has made his way up into third, but Spun to Run has run away. Gerard Ortiz and Spun to Run, the real deal of the Dirt Mile. They won it by 3.5 lengths. Omaha Beach was second. Blue Chipper was third. Snapper Sinclair was fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday afternoon. That was Larry Colmus with the call of the 2019 Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile and a massive wire-to-wire win for Spun to Run, who is trained by, or was trained by, Carlos Guerrero. And Carlos, the uncle of my special guest on Trainer Talk here this afternoon, that is Michelle Giangiulio. And we're going to continue my visit with Michelle shortly. You heard her talk about that particular day, that particular race, and that particular horse in the first half of the program. If you missed any of the show, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast at your leisure. It's there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts as well. Another way you can tune into the show whenever you get some time. Well, Michelle, that clip, I had to take you on a little trip down memory lane, considering the fact that we were talking about Spun to Run in the first half of the program, and you said that that was a day that meant so much to you. So I had to take you on a little trip down memory lane. Did it sound as good today as it did 2 years ago?
Oh, it did. It gave me goosebumps. It wasn't even like, I didn't actually get to train the horse, but just to see Carlos win a race like that, it was just it was a special day for sure.
So you are now living in New York and training on your own. I mentioned at the top of the show, and if folks are just joining us, I'll reiterate the fact that you have started two horses in your name. You have a second and a third, which is not bad, but I know you're probably jonesing to get that very first win, right?
Yeah, I am. I know. I was really hoping to get it the other day when it finished second. The horse ran really good. But, definitely hoping to get the win soon.
Tell me about saddling your first ever starter in your own name.
You know, I was a little nervous, and I don't really ever get nervous unless it's like a really big race. But I had a lot of people watching, you know, my whole family and all my friends and everything. So it was a little nerve-wracking. But the horse had a really good shot in the race, so it was excited and nervous at the same time.
When you walk into the paddock and you see other established trainers there and you look around and you realize you're fulfilling a dream that you've had since you were a little girl, what was that like?
Kind of relieving in a way, just to be there, you know. I've saddled a lot of horses, you know, it's not really anything new to be in the paddock, but to be there for yourself was very exciting and proud moment. And to see the horse run really well was also really, you know, I felt really proud afterwards. Even though he got claimed, it was kind of, you know, a bummer, but, you know, it's part of the game. But at least he ran a good race and, you know, I felt very proud.
Yeah, that's a wonderful point that you bring up. He was in a claiming race, so he gets claimed. You lose the horse. You're just getting started with this career, and you're trying to build up a stable. Is it a little frustrating when you lose the first horse that you saddle?
Yeah, well, the first one actually hit really hard because it was the only horse I had at the time. I was still working for Kelly Breen, and I only had one horse under my own name, and they claimed him. So it was a real bummer the next morning to come back and have only one empty stall. You know, like I was really working hard on just the one horse, and you know, we were looking to claim more. Yeah, I had to get a starter to be able to claim. So, you know, and we wanted to win the race, so I had to put him in a good spot where he had a good chance to win. So that one hit a little hard. Yeah, that was a tough one.
Yeah, I can imagine. How does a trainer go about building up a stable when they go out on their own? I know there's several ways you can do it, but what's the approach you're taking anyway?
Well, I'm very fortunate to have an owner of Marshall Graham, who's involved with 10 Strike Racing, who I met actually through Carlos. And he had sent me a horse from Fairgrounds because, yeah, I had my trainer's license, but the rule is you have to have a starter to be able to claim anything. So it's not like you can just get your trainer's license to start claiming horses. You have to get a horse from somewhere. So Marshall sent me a horse from Fairgrounds who was Parade Field. And, you know, gave me a little bit of time with him. I think I had him for about 6 weeks before I ran him. And, you know, that's kind of how it got going. And, you know, he got claimed, obviously, and we were looking to claim some, but lost a few shakes and didn't really see anything that we liked. So he had a horse that, you know, wasn't running so well at Oaklawn, and, you know, he claimed him at Churchill and sent him out to Arkansas, and wasn't doing very well out there. I don't think he really cared for the track. And he sent him to me, and that was the horse I ran the other day that finished second. He was just very stressed when he came in. You could tell he didn't handle the trip very well. Obviously, probably looked like he didn't handle Arkansas very well either. I've heard it can, you know, tear horses up pretty good. It's a tough track, and, you know, it can be really stressful. So he just really needed some time to really get back into himself and, you know, put on some weight and, you know, come around. And he really did. You know, I gave him 2.5 months till I ran him, and, you know, he ran huge the other day.
Was that Easy Shot?
Yeah.
Was he claimed too?
Yeah, they took him too.
So now you're down to zero horses again.
I have three right now. Yeah,
oh, okay.
I had four, and now I'm down to three. So, I mean, we're looking to claim. It's just been really difficult because, you know, everybody's looking to claim right now heading into Saratoga. So there have been huge shakes on every horse that's a little interesting. So it's been hard. You know, you want to run the horses where they're going to win, but yet, you know, you may end up with an empty stable at the same time and then not be able to claim another one back because you're, you know, constantly trying to shake for a horse. So it's not easy. It's very difficult.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very competitive, cutthroat type of game when you get involved with the claiming side of our sport.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, in New York is the best way to put it. It is cutthroat. They see a new name and they don't care. You know, they see a horse that they want, and they're going to go for it. It's just, you know, it's just how it is here. It's very competitive.
Will you go to Saratoga?
Yes, I am going to go. Trying to figure out a stall situation, but planning on going for sure, yeah.
Explain how that works. There are people listening. You say trying to figure out a stall situation. There are people listening that have no idea what that means. Explain how that works for a trainer.
Well, this year I think they're under a lot of stress right now because Churchill's going to close during the summer. So Saratoga is going to be really packed. Like, even though Saratoga is enormous, there's stalls all over the place. It fills up quickly. So, you know, they got to make sure all the big guys have enough stalls and everything. And somebody like me who's only had two starters and they look at that, they don't really want to give you, you know, a stable. So it's tough because, you know, either you got to rent stalls at Harness Track or try to borrow stalls from somebody. You know, the racing office is trying to work with me to see what we can do because I can't really afford to rent stalls at Harness Track right now. And it's kind of unfair if you're going to rent my starters, because if my horses didn't get claimed, I'd have a lot more, you know, starters. But, you know, it's how the game works. So it's really tough in the situation I'm in right now. It's a really hard time of year to get started too. It wasn't really like planned to start now, but it's just kind of how things worked out. I would have loved to like start going into the winter, you know, that would have been ideal, but just kind of how things worked out and horses came and, you know, here we are.
Yeah, that's a great point. How did you end up in this position of training on your own right now?
Well, I was to the point where I just don't want to be an assistant anymore. I've been an assistant for about 7 or 8 years now. And obviously the goal was always to be a trainer. And after I had left Morley's, I went through a couple different that I was an assistant for and trying to find a job that was able to kind of help be an assistant and have the trainer kind of help me get started. And it's really hard to find that, you know, you're going to work for somebody. They want you to focus on their horses, not, you know, focus on their horses and your horses. So it was hard to find that specific. It's kind of where I ended up with Kelly Breen. I was a foreman over there, and I had a couple horses for myself, and that was a good job. You know, I just stayed there over the winter, and I had a few horses that were going to be heading my way before I got, you know, when Easy Shot came, and then we were looking to claim some horses, and it was really difficult because I'm doing all the work myself. I don't have a payroll. I'm grooming, I'm galloping, I'm hot walking. So it was really hard to do that along with working another job. So it's kind of how I fell into just, I ended up claiming two horses back to back, and I ended up having four, and you know, I was making enough money where I can just do all the work myself and don't have to work another job. And that's kind of where I'm at the moment, just trying to, you know, stay afloat, trying to claim another horse to be able to, you know, keep things going. So that's where we are at this moment.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like it's a massive challenge, right? When you starting any business, for example, is a massive challenge, and you have to work your tail off, and that's the only way that you can be successful. And it mm-hmm. seems to me like that's exactly the position that you're in right now, Michelle.
Yeah, it's very challenging. You know, like I said, you want to run the horses where they can win, but at the same time, it's usually a claiming race and you need to drop them in price. And, you know, you have that chance that somebody's going to claim your horse, and you can end up having two horses gone in a few weeks or even in the same week, and not be able to get another one back for a little while. So it's, you know, it is challenging. You know, you want to keep the business going and you want to win races. But at the same time, you don't want to lose your whole stable. So it's very challenging.
You mentioned the fact that you are doing everything. You're getting on the horses. You're handling everything that's involved with training, because right now that's how you have to do it. You can't afford a whole big payroll with a whole bunch of help to take care of those horses. And thankfully, you're not at the point yet where you have 20 or 30 horses, because then it would be really hard to do this, almost impossible, I would imagine, for somebody to do that on their
own. You know, something that along the way of the trainers I've worked for, I've always, you know, everybody's given me a little piece of advice, and they always told me to don't grow too soon, because the supply cost is enormous for a racing stable. It's so expensive to get everything you need. So I've just been doing it slowly, you know, buying little by little and building up. You know, right now I have everything I need for four horses, which is great, you know, about four or five, I have everything I need. And I can stay at that number for the next four to 6 months, heading into the winter and start claiming some more horses after Saratoga, or get a few at Saratoga. That'd be great. That's kind of my goal. Just to stay small at the moment and keep working the way I'm working, and just build up slowly and, you know, hopefully be successful.
Yeah, and considering the fact that you are running your own business, you have to pay for all of the different materials and feed and all those kind of things that you need. What are those expenses that a new trainer has to deal with as they're getting started?
Just like the tools in general, as far as what you need, or like what the expenses are, you mean?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. I mean, what things go into running your own business as a horse trainer, and especially for somebody just getting started, all the things you need to acquire to do your job?
Yeah, there's so many things you need when you want to get down to basics. You need screw eyes, you need snaps for the webbing, which costs about $70 a piece, and you need the crossbars, you need tie chains, you need a halter, you need a lead shank, you need bandages, you need a saddle, you need tack. I mean, there's such a long, 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 long list of supplies, and that's all money coming out of your pocket. So that's kind of why I was trying to find a trainer that I could work for and, you know, build up my own thing, which is what Kelly Breen was helping me do. I was using his tack, which was great. That was a huge help, because that's at least $700-$800, just tack itself, along with bridle and saddle together, is, you know, close to $1,000 you could put into it to getting good gear. So that helped me out, where, you know, I could save some money, and I was able to save up enough money to go and buy my own tack and everything. And, you know, I bought one webbing at a time and things like that. You need water buckets, and there's so many things you need, and you got to get, you got to pay for feed, you know, you got to get hay, and you got to get shavings, and that's all money you got to put out front out of your own pocket. You know, you get paid from the owner after the month. But that's, you know, there's a lot of things you got to put out of your own money until you get paid.
Do you ever stop and think, what on earth did I get myself into?
Yeah, I think that a little bit, but you know, I've ran a lot of barns, so I knew what I was getting into. I didn't really see so much of the numbers, but you know, I had an idea. I knew it was going to be a lot of money, but I know exactly what I need, which is great. You know, it's not like I'm guessing on what I need. I know exactly what I need to get, and I've done my research on who has the best prices and things like that. So I feel like I was well prepared for it. Not so much on the money end, you know. It's tough living in New York, so it's not like I have a ton of money. But, you know, I've done my research, and I know exactly what it needs, so that definitely helps.
Visiting with trainer Michelle Giangiulio here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. You may be hearing that name for the very first time as she is just getting started with that training career. Michelle, I have had many trainers come on this program over the years and afterwards come back to me and say, hey, there was an owner that was listening to the show. They enjoyed the conversation, and they actually sent them a horse or two to train. And there's a chance that could happen for you, too. So if you were talking to a prospective owner today, how would you sum up the Michelle Giangiulio training philosophy and your approach to training horses?
Best way to put it, I'm very hands-on. I've been around horses my entire life. You know, I want to be aggressive and win races, and main thing is put horses where they belong. That's the biggest challenge of horse racing nowadays is, you know, people want to put them in a higher spot, but they need to run them where they can win.
And I can imagine that in itself is a skill.
Yeah, for sure. One of the main logics of horse racing is to, you know, run them where they can win. You get lucky and improve a horse, but, you know, most of the time you want to put them in the right spot and you know, and be aggressive. When you're aggressive, you win races. That's one of my biggest philosophies.
Yeah. You learn from a guy like Kelly Breen, and Kelly helps you with giving you a couple of the things you need to get started. That was a wonderful point that you made there. Kelly's a guy that has had a lot of success. He's trained more than 800 winners, closing in on 900, actually. Many graded stakes winners. He knows how to get a good horse. And he's always been, whenever he's come out with me, he's always been a really fun interview because he's always so positive and upbeat, and he's got a great sense of humor. Tell me about your time working with Kelly.
Yeah, Kelly's a really, really cool guy. Very laid back. He's always in the same kind of mood every day, which is great. I love that. You know what to expect when they're coming into work. And you know what he was great about? He didn't come around much in the wintertime. You know, he stays in Palm Meadows most of the time, which I was, you know, I only worked for him for over the winter. But he still came in, you know, a few times through the month. And he wouldn't come in and try to change things. He'd come in and work with you and be like, hey, how's this going? You know, however, he would, you know, a rider would come over and they see the boss, and immediately when he asked the boss what you want me to do today, they say, whatever this horse has been doing. And John Atfield is the assistant. So he would tell the rider, ask John. John's the boss here. You know, like he wouldn't come in and change all kinds of things. He would come in and go along with how we've been doing it, which I really appreciated. Because that would be something that would bother me if you work for a trainer and, you know, they leave you here to run the show for them for so many months at a time and come in and want to change all kinds of things instead of trying to figure out how it's already been going and it's been working. I'm going to work with you on how that's been going. You know, that's something I really appreciated from Kelly. I really like that about him.
How about Tom Morley? What was he like to be around?
Marley was great. I mean, we worked together for almost 3 years. I worked for him. He was a lot of fun to work with. And, you know, when it comes to the horses, he was, you know, he was down to business. He was serious. And we worked hard over there. You know, we worked on those horses. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't just, you know, go out and train and they come in and eat. It was, you know, we iced every horse and they all get done up and they would get worked on. And we did good together. You know, we worked good as a team. We had an awesome group of people that worked underneath of us. We had some really good grooms and, you know, built up a really good team together.
It certainly wasn't easy either because you had to go through the COVID era working with Tom Morley and being part of that team. And I know Tom's always approached it as being part of a family as opposed to being part of a employee-boss relationship. But there was a point last year where Barn Foreman, the 63-year-old Martin Zapata, passed away from COVID, and that was something that really just, you know, you and the team with Tom Morley, that was just devastating.
Yeah, it was. It was probably the most stressful time I've ever dealt with in my life. It was really scary at the time, too, because when Martin passed, it was really right when COVID was starting to get serious. You know, some people were taking it seriously, some people weren't. And, you know, everything was just such a question. Everything was such up in the air. And it was really tough because Tom had just had a newborn baby in January. So she was only a few months old. So he tried to, you know, he came to work every day, but he kept his distance. You know, he was very careful, which I totally understood. You know, I didn't blame him. And he ended up never getting it, thankfully. I did. I tested positive bodies after they did the blood test on everybody a few months later. But it was just really, really stressful and scary because didn't know what was going to go on. And I had so many employees taking out, like not coming in for weeks at a time just because they were scared. I had multiple employees get sick. I had like three employees in the hospital at one point that were very sick. And, you know, they ended up being okay except for Martin, which was really, really hard on all of us because he worked with us for almost 2 years, and, you know, he was a good employee. We really liked him. He was a great guy. Very sad with what happened, and, you know, he deteriorated quickly. I believe he actually ended up going into kidney failure. But, yeah, that was a really, really hard time. And something that I'll always, you know, I'll never forget, that's for sure. It was very scary.
Yeah, they say, you know, that things like that will make you stronger going forward, and it sounds like it certainly has. I'm sure it has for Tom Morley and the team too.
Absolutely, yeah. Everyone in that barn, we all went through the same thing, you know. We all felt the same fear, and we were all trying to be safe and careful, and it was just stressful because we had a barn full of horses and a lot of people weren't coming into work, so, you know, I had to take on a lot more work and try to find more employees, and while everybody's like scattering and not coming in, you know, it was really difficult.
Yeah, and of course, Michelle Giangiulio, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, now facing her own set of challenges, going out on her own, starting her own operation, her own training profession, and boy, it's gotten off to a pretty good start, though. Two starters to date, a second and a third. That is not too shabby, and I think, Michelle, when you think about that, I know you want the win, but you have to be proud of what you've accomplished so far.
Yeah, I am. I go back and watch my replays quite often just to feel that, you know, I am proud. I'm glad of how they've been running so far. You know, it's only been two, but they've both showed up and both ran really well. So, you know, it's great to see that because I put a lot of work into it, you know, so it's great to see them run.
You know, I always enjoy asking trainers this next question because the answers can be so diverse. If you were to be able to spend a full day with any trainer, past or present, and you could pick their brain and you could have lunch and dinner with them and ask them all the questions you wanted to ask, who would that one trainer be?
I'd have to say probably Dwayne Lucas. Cause
great choice.
I have sat down with him, not much, just quick questions, but he's always just so educational. I did read a part of the book that he wrote, and it had so many good life quotes in there that I kind of like to base myself off of. And, you know, he's the king, you know. He what can't he teach you? I'm sure there's always something that he could tell you that, you know, you could learn from.
He was on this program with me a few years back, and I had the privilege to sit down with him in his office at Saratoga, and we spent the full hour, and it could have been 6, 7, 8 hours with with Wayne Lucas.
Yeah, I can imagine.
he's so good, and he's so well-spoken, and he tells a story like nobody else.
Yeah, I think he would definitely be my number one pick there, for sure. Yeah.
What do you think you might ask him if you were sitting down having lunch with him and you could ask him any training question that you wanted? What would it be?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'd have to ask him something like, you know, going into like the Kentucky Derby on how you would train a horse going in. I mean, my philosophy, I always don't want to change anything, you know, especially going into a big race, keep them training the same. But I'd love to know, like, just his process going into a big, how he trained the horse that week, or just how he'd handle everything. I'm sure he'd know better than anyone.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he's done it for so many years and done it so well, and what a great person to spend some time with. And I have really enjoyed spending time with Michelle Giangiulio here on this edition of Trainer Talk. Michelle, we're down to about the final minute and a half. So before we wrap it up, I always like to end by asking trainers to let me know something about them we haven't talked about yet. So are there any other hobbies or interests outside of racing that you enjoy taking part in?
Well, horses are my life. It's always been my hobby was horses, so I can't really say I have much else. I got my dog. She's my baby. I have a little blue heeler dog. She's 4 years old. She's like my little sidekick. She takes up most of my time outside the racetrack. But other than that, I don't have too many hobbies. I spend most of my days at the barn, so horses are my life. And they always have been, so.
Well, it's exactly what's going to make you successful in what you're doing now. Michelle, I can't thank you enough for spending some time. It's been a delight to hear your story. All the best moving forward. Good luck, and we'll be following.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, trainer Michelle Giangiulio here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you did miss any portion of that conversation, and it was fantastic, just head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. Follow us on social media as well, at HRN on Twitter. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening.